They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Howard Beck is here joining me on the day after Election Day. I guess it still is kind of Election Day. Election week, Howard, in America is what this has become, right? We're now, you know, part of the never-ending cycle of being glued to CNN or Fox or MSNBC or whatever it is that you watch out there. But I've had my TV on for the better part of 24 hours, Howard. I don't know about you.
I did turn it off to go to sleep. I thought that was the healthy thing to do. I got up. I resisted the urge to turn it on again immediately, but I caved after about 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. I would say this, not to, you know, we have other things to talk about, of course, but, you know, players driving, you know, the black vote, especially during the NBA's restart, if it turns out that Joe Biden wins the presidency, you know, they'll deserve some credit for it, right? Like, I mean, if voter turnout is the key to all this, and it sure seems like it's going to set some records when it comes to voter turnout, how players participated in this process, I think, will be influential. I think a lot of players can feel good about themselves and what they did during that bubble to push voting to the forefront as hard as they did.
Yeah, and we'll never be able to quantify that, of course, Chris.
Right.
We'll never know exactly what the impact was. And there were so many different forces at work in this particular election cycle across our country. But the rise of athlete activism, and in the NBA's case, maybe the strongest of any of the leagues, well, the NBA and the WNBA both, but the platform that they have and the way that they've deployed it over the last several months was incredible, and absolutely that's meaningful. Absolutely, that helps. You know, you'll never know how many more voters there were because of it. But listen, at a minimum, we know that a bunch of NBA arenas became voting precincts because NBA players pushed hard for it and got that commitment from the arenas that hadn't already. They got more commitments in the wake of the Wildcat strike in the bubble. So, you know, at a minimum, NBA players contributed to making sure that more people had access to a voting precinct amid a pandemic and a safer, socially distanced place to vote. And in addition to that, of course, you know, the LeBron James is more than a vote organization trying to, you know, re-enfranchise voters and battle back against, you know, the disenfranchisement of voters, especially in the black community. All of that has had some kind of impact. We'll never know the extent, but for sure, NBA players have played a big role in this election.
Yeah, and you know, even among their own ranks, for voter registration to go from, what, 20% in 2016 to the high 90s in this election cycle. I wrote about this week. I mean, you know, LeBron's More Than a Vote campaign, turning out 40,000-plus poll workers, you know, getting people registered nationwide. I mean, you're right, it's not something you can quantify, but I'd be shocked if what they did wasn't significantly impactful. I think they can be proud of what they accomplished, regardless of the outcome of this race. All right, let's jump into some of the more basketball-centric topics here that we're here to talk about. I want to start with next season, whenever we get to next season. Sometime later this week, the NBPA will vote on a proposal to restart the season on December 22nd. The broad strokes of this proposal are a 72-game season that ends in mid-May, with the finals ending sometime in late July. That proposal would allow the NBA to fulfill its TV contracts, that's important, and get back on a regular schedule for the following season, which is very important to the NBA. The Athletic is reporting that players see a December 22nd start date as inevitable. Howard, a Christmas start once seemed a little pie in the sky to me. Now, we may have basketball on Christmas Day. What do you think of the latest developments?
Well, you know, the NBA telegraphed what it wanted months ago, when they sent over the plans for the NBA restart in the bubble, and it as part of it said, and we'd like to start the 2020-21 season on December 1st. Now, there was immediate skepticism and immediate pushback by Michelle Roberts of the NBPA saying, you know, look, December 1st, it's going to be too soon. And it's not that the NBA, the league officials thought, oh, we could absolutely do November 1st as they started, you know, the summer plans. It was more, I think, the signal that, listen, we do not want a permanent shift of the NBA schedule. And this is before the restart had happened. This is before we saw ratings crater in the over the summer where the NBA has never played and where it's going up against baseball and family vacations and then eventually football. They always wanted, I think, to get back on schedule as soon as possible. And that's what that December 1st date signaled to me, whether it was realistic or not. So December 22nd to December 25th range is about where you would expect to end up if you gave an overly optimistic, rosy December 1st start date, realizing that it was probably going to have to be a little bit later than that. But you and I both know, Chris, and I think fans of this league know pretty well by now, how important December 25th is, both as a tentpole day for the league, five games. They own that day. They've got the full attention of sports fans that day. It's the unofficial kickoff of the season. You know, the season starts in late October, but a lot of fans don't really start tuning in until Christmas. It's got a lot of weight, and it also has a lot of monetary value. So I don't think we should be surprised that they're pushing that hard for that. I think the biggest surprise, Chris, is how much opposition there has been by the players, because the vast majority of them have had 3 months off minimum, and some of them much more than that. And, you know, the eight teams that didn't make the bubble have been off for basically 9 months already. So, or will have been by then. I'm surprised at the intensity of the opposition from the players or the resistance to starting. I get it. Like, if you're the Lakers and the Heat, if you're the Nuggets and the Celtics, the teams that were in the conference finals, I get it. It's not ideal, but every dollar that's at stake, every dollar that the NBA says they could lose or recoup, half of that belongs to the players. So this is not some like negotiation like we see during collective bargaining battles where the NBA comes to the players and say, we need X, Y, Z. And the players say, well, what are you giving us back for it? No, this literally is a shared loss or a shared opportunity to recoup money. So this is not an ask of the players. Yeah, it's their bodies. It is their, you know, their well-being that's at stake when you have a shorter turnaround. But what the league is asking is of the players as their 50-50 partners to get them back on track, to make as much as they can in what will still be a season with a lot of losses because they can't have fans in the building to start, and maybe at all. And it is also in the players' best interest to get back on a normal NBA calendar that allows them to get on a completely normal one next season. Because if you finish by the end of July, now you can start again in October the way you normally would, and things are back to normal. If you push this to MLK Day, as players were pushing for, or at least some factions were pushing for, well, then you're throwing off the following season too, and you're losing a bunch of money from starting a month later. So I don't understand where the players are coming from on this one, especially because unless you're the Lakers and Heat, the vast majority of players should be like, okay, good, we're ready to go. We haven't played in months. Let's go.
Yeah, I think the fundamental shift in all this was when the NBA realized that fans in the stands was not going to happen. And that may just be for the first half of the season. That may be the entirety of the season. But I do believe, Howard, if we were in a different place in this country, and I'm not talking about the nonsense, you know, being spouted about how we're turning the corner. We're not. You know, cases are going through the roof. And whether you think it's a, you know, life-threatening illness or not, you are simply not going to have states, which have the power here, open up arenas or allow large crowds in arenas while those case numbers are still on the rise. So given the climate, the NBA, I think, realized and said, look, we've got to maximize the number of games we play for television revenue, and that means starting on Christmas Day. And I'm with you. I understand the Lakers and the Heat are going to get pretty well screwed. They're basically going to have a few weeks off before they have to start, you know, kind of mentally and physically getting their bodies right to get back into training camp and then physically go through a grind after experiencing not just a long playoff grind, but a long playoff grind in extreme circumstances. So I do have sympathy for the Lakers and Heat to a slightly lesser degree, the Celtics and the Nuggets, but you can't make a decision about the NBA based on the feelings of two or four teams. You know, the Knicks, the Hawks, like all these other teams that have been sitting around since early March, like they're ready to go and they should be ready to go. So, you know, I think you almost have to say, sorry, LeBron, sorry, Jeannie Buss, sorry, Pat Riley, sorry, Jimmy Butler, but this is kind of the way it goes for the overall health of this league and for the benefit of all the players. And by the way, LeBron has talked a lot about looking out for the rest of the players in the league, and he's done a lot of things towards that end. Like, I would think making sure his guys got paid and sacrificing whatever he has to sacrifice physically to get back out there on the floor, that's in the best interest of most of these players. So I think this happens. I think that the overwhelming number of players will vote for this Christmas week start, and we're back in training camp and ready to go in early December.
I agree, and that's what I have believed from the minute this discussion started, when there was this pushback and Michelle Roberts goes on the record saying, you know, I'm hearing a lot of, you know, concern and pushback from players. They don't want to do this. And all I kept thinking, Chris, was
who
this is a players union. This is a players union with 450 guys. The Lakers and Heat make up at most 30 of the 450. And if you want to throw in the other 30 players from the Nuggets and Celtics because they have a shorter turnaround from being in the conference finals, you still have the vast majority of players who it's in their interest to get going soon and with sooner and who do not have the shorter turnaround. And I just felt like as powerful as LeBron is, as powerful as his buddy Chris Paul is as president of the players union, those are not the voices that are ultimately going to matter. It's a players union, one player, one vote. LeBron gets the same number of votes as everybody else. And I don't think he can talk the Warriors and Timberwolves and Cavaliers and Knicks and Hawks and all the teams that haven't played since March into saying, no, for my benefit or for my team's benefit, we should put this off another month. I mean, that I don't think that was probably the message. I'm being facetious and oversimplifying the way that discussion would go, clearly. But that's what it would break down to. And it just doesn't make any sense. The majority of players would have more benefit than detriment by going and getting going sooner.
And if we're being honest, Howard, we're really only talking about the Lakers the last week or so. And that's largely because, you know, we heard from Danny Green and there's been some chatter about the Lakers. Plus, they're an older team with guys that are in the early to mid-30s as part of that core. I haven't heard anything from the Heat about pushback when it comes to this restart. I know I haven't heard anything from Boston about pushback, and Denver's a bunch of 12-year-olds too. So like they're really young. Like they can, I mean, they'll bounce back. Like, I mean, Miami, especially, Miami's probably like already in training camp. Like they probably took a week off and went right back to it. So it's really only talking about the 12 to 15 guys on the Lakers at this point that may be the most disinterested in returning this quickly. And I don't think you can, part of my surprise in a way came because, and I said this last week, in interviews with me and with others, Michelle Roberts has taken 2020 off the table. And I was using that as a baseline for, you know, any kind of thought process about when the NBA was going to restart. But as this has gained momentum and as the NBA has made it clear that this is the best way to maximize the revenue, the losses that we, meaning the NBA and the players, will suffer will be catastrophic. I just believe this was going to happen. The ball can't stop rolling, for lack of a better metaphor, because just 12 guys or 15 guys don't want to play. It just can't work that way.
And just a couple of quick footnotes on this, Chris. One is, no matter when they get started, even if they do get started before Christmas and, you know, then can lock in that much more money in the 72 games and what that provides in terms of regional TV contracts, everything else, we know they're still going to start without fans in the buildings, and that there's no certainty that we'll have fans back in the buildings at any point in the coming season. That still means hundreds of millions in losses from having empty buildings. So that's one caveat, just not to be a downer. But the second caveat is we're going without a bubble. The NBA, we all rightly praised them for what they pulled off in Orlando, but I've said all along, you know, in some ways that was the easy part, because once you establish the bubble, as long as no one violates the rules, as long as everybody does what they're supposed to do, you've kept out the virus because that's what it was designed to do. The league will not have that, you know, that context to work within anymore, because they're going back to home markets or regional markets or something. Like, we don't know exactly how it will work, but it's not going to be a bubble, which means the risk of the virus disrupting the season is going to be much, much higher, because people are back living with their families, people coming and going. People, you know, we've seen it all across the country. Forget sports, just day-to-day life, day-to-day, you know, just citizens in this country and around the world. You know, COVID fatigue sets in and people start going back to their old habits, their old routines, and the virus is spiking. We're in the midst of this massive wave. And so I just think we should throw up a lot of caution signs that as the NBA gets started again, you know, it's the right thing to get going sooner than later. It's impossible to create another bubble and ask players to do that for an entire season. But it means that they're starting the next season with considerably more risk in terms of the virus. And, you know, we don't know what that will mean for them, and then how the league will handle that either. There's still a lot that they have to figure out.
Yeah, plenty of it. That's a separate conversation. Will a non-bubble environment work when you have, you know, not only the traveling that goes on with the NBA, and part of this proposal is that they will reduce travel by 25% through a variety of different ways, but you have guys in close contact with each other. You know, as you mentioned, guys go home, in and out. There's a real high potential for significant spread, whatever that means. You know, I think there's a real high possibility of that happening during a non-bubble type of season. But hey, look, it's still good to be an NBA owner, Howard, because we did just see the Jazz sell for $1.6 billion. Like that number, I don't know how about you, that number kind of jumped out at me. Like the Utah Jazz, I love Salt Lake City. I love Utah in general, Park City, one of my favorite places to visit. But for the Utah Jazz, during a pandemic, going into a season, Howard, where every NBA owner will tell you you're going to lose money, or at least not make anywhere near as much as you did, to sell for $1.6 billion is pretty damn impressive.
That $1.6 billion, I didn't see like the itemized receipt. Did that come with like rights to some shoreline on the Great Salt Lake? Did it come with like a couple of ski resorts in Park City? Like, there's got to be more to it than just, you know, Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert's contracts. And the whatever, the Vivint, whatever, home something arena. There's got to be more. There's got to be, I'm thinking ski resorts. I'm thinking beachfront on the Salt Lake.
There's got to be something, because the Jazz are in the NBA's or the U.S.'s 30th media market. And it goes for $1.6 billion. That's wild. So
incredible. Something
tells me owners, not that we're hearing, well, we are kind of hearing some belly aching from owners because they've conducted, you know, layoffs, and some of that happens during a pandemic. But if you want out, owners, there's a golden parachute awaiting you. You will, wherever you are in the NBA, you will be able to make money off your investment. All right, the big story this week, Howard, in Pennsylvania is the vote. The second biggest story is the 76ers, a close second, right behind what's happening in Pennsylvania with the voting. The Sixers will start next season with a leadership structure that looks very different from what they had last season. Days after the Sixers hired Doc Rivers, they gave him a new boss, hiring Daryl Morey, recently of Houston, as the new team president. Elton Brand, the incumbent GM, was given a new extension as well. Howard, let's start with Daryl. There were some, like Tillman Fertitta, the owner of the Rockets, that thought Morey might take some time off after leaving Houston. He basically took a long weekend after taking and getting the job in Philadelphia. Your thoughts on the Sixers' change at the top?
So when Daryl announced, or when it was decided that he was going to move on, however that news came out, but when Daryl decided to move on, and there were certain, you know, reasons listed, all of which I thought were valid. I mean, he'd been going at it for 13 years with the Rockets, I think 12 as the GM. He works as hard as anybody in this league at that job. Plenty of people do. I'm not saying he's different in that regard, but it's a hard job. And and Daryl is incredibly aggressive, and you know, we know he's as transaction happy as anybody in the league. And they had kind of maxed out. You know, I've said for the last couple of years, I thought the Rockets had pretty much plateaued, and especially once they made the deal for Westbrook, which had the fingerprints of Fertitta and James Harden all over it. And I always thought not so much Daryl Morey. It didn't seem like a Daryl kind of trade at all when you consider, you know, what Westbrook is and the picks they had to give up and the fact that Chris Paul is frankly a better player and had a shorter contract. None of that made sense. Like Daryl walking away in the wake of where the Rockets were in the wake of another disappointing end to their season. Obviously the Hong Kong tweet last year and the tensions that created with ownership, all of it made sense. I really did think, Chris, that he was going to take some time off and chill and catch his breath and spend some time with family. I knew he'd be back. I was certain he'd be back. But no, I did not think it would be after, as you put it well, a long weekend. But I will say this too. When that news happened of Daryl first stepping down, I said on a couple different shows, wherever, I said, if I'm any owner in the NBA, aside from a handful, if I've got Danny Ainge, I'm fine. If I've got Sam Presti, I'm fine. But 25 teams in the NBA should throw their guy overboard in a heartbeat to grab Daryl Morey. And that's what the Sixers did. They threw Elton Brand kind of overboard. They gave him a life raft and they're towing him. And they gave him a nice contract extension, so he'll be fine. And this is, by the way, this is not a reflection of Elton Brand. This is one, I believe, that the Sixers rightly read the situation, which is you had a chance to get a top five GM. You do that every time, just as they pounced on Doc Rivers too. And Elton Brand, look, it was weird. If you go back, remember all the way that unfolded. Like they had gone all these different directions, and they weren't sure what they wanted to do. They finally elevate Elton Brand to that position. He'd never really, worked in a front office. It was all new to him, and they had this kind of this structure where it was kind of unclear who really held the power in that front office. It was all very, very strange anyway. So it's not like they were settled there. It's not like they just threw a veteran GM overboard to hire Daryl. But they were the place that made the most sense in the short term. They were the place that I thought would hire Daryl a year from now, or after next season. I thought it would happen, but I just didn't think it was going to happen this soon. But kudos to the Sixers, because I think that's the right way to run a franchise, Chris. Identify great talent, whether it's a player, a coach, a trainer, an equipment manager, I don't care who, sports science folks, analytics folks, and the GM. If you've got the opportunity to hire somebody great, you go and get them. And you spare no expense. Yeah.
Yeah. It was definitely handled bizarrely, the whole process, because I hate using that word when it comes to Philadelphia, but it starts with Elton Brand effectively consolidating power within the organization when last season ended. And now it ends with Elton as what exactly? And I think I have some question about who carries the biggest bat in that organization. Daryl is the team president, but Doc Rivers was hired first. And Doc Rivers in the past has been, he's been a team president as well, or whatever his role was with the LA Clippers. He's a heavily influential guy. He was with the Celtics organization. Is he just the head coach? Is he someone that, if you're Josh Harris or any of the ownership people in Philadelphia, is Doc Rivers the one you listen to if there's a dispute over what happens with personnel? I think the dynamic there is interesting. And I think Elton, they gave Elton an extension too. It's like, well, what are we doing here? Are we signing everybody to like the equivalent of a 5-year deal? And I like Elton Brand. And I've said this before, Howard. Elton, like, you make your own bed here. You put yourself in this position by letting Jimmy Butler walk away and then watching Butler take his team to the NBA Finals, losing J.J. Redick and not replacing with anybody that can shoot, and watching shooting become a major problem for your team. So the mistakes that were made along the way, Elton Brand has to have ownership of and deserves any kind of fallout as a result of it. But I don't know about you. I think the dynamic's weird in that organization.
That organization's always been a little weird. They've been, I don't even want to say low-key dysfunctional. I think just the fact that they've had just enough success and they've been, they were fun for a couple of years there before they became instead a disappointment, is kind of obscured the fact that they've always been a little dysfunctional. Like they've got multiple owners who always have their hands in everything. They had a front office structure where it was never clear who was in charge. Brett Brown had no authority whatsoever as the coach, was constantly being undermined from above. And that kept him from really doing what he needed to do to keep Embiid and Simmons on track. And so like they have not been great in terms of chain of command and being on the same page. All that said, they are aggressive, they spend, and they have now spent to get some really talented people in really important positions, specifically and most importantly, Doc Rivers and Daryl Morey. Now, Doc and Daryl, I don't want to overdo the Celtics connection, but they do go all the way back to Boston, where Daryl was assistant GM under Danny Ainge and Doc was still coaching there. They overlapped. I don't know how strong the relationship is, but those are two guys who are, I think, really great communicators. And while they might both be used to having the authority or being the ultimate authority on basketball personnel matters, Daryl has always struck me as being a collaborative type. And I don't think, like, Daryl doesn't have to be the biggest voice in the room. He's an important voice, and it's going to be his decision. He's team president. But he doesn't strike me as the kind of person who needs to dominate the room. I think he and Doc can collaborate well. I think the key then is going to be, does ownership, now that, because I always say that the best way to run a team, if you're an owner in this league, hire the best people, the smartest people, understand that you, the owner, do not know anything about basketball. You may think you do, but you don't. Hire the best basketball people and then get the hell out of the way. Well, they've done that. They hired Daryl and Doc. Now they need to get the hell out of the way. And that part of it is still an if. But I'm not that concerned about, like, I think this is the most definitive authority structure they've had in years, Chris. Doc will run that locker room it much more authoritatively than Brett Brown did. That was just not Brett Brown's strength. Doc's got a big personality and a big influence. Like, guys will listen to him. So that takes care of that. And Daryl's got the cachet to run that front office the way that he needs to.
Yeah, he does. And the only thing I get leery of is when a coach is hired before a general manager.
Yes.
Because the general manager didn't have time to, or didn't have the opportunity to hire somebody whose philosophies are in line with his own. And maybe Daryl Morey, if Doc was available, he would have jumped on the chance to hire him for all the reasons that you articulated. The voice in that locker room, the presence he's going to have, he will have in that locker room. But it didn't happen that way. So that always gives me a little reason for pause. One last thought on the 76ers. I want to play you some audio from the press conference. Daryl and Doc were both asked about the Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons dynamic. Here's what they said.
I think they absolutely can work together, but I'll turn, Doc's been here a little longer than me. I'll turn to him. I mean, he's thought even longer about how they can work together.
Yeah, I have no doubt they can. Again, I haven't been in the lab with them yet, but I know they can. I think we have changed the narrative. They haven't won yet. Not that they can't win. The can't should be taken out. But there's a lot of combinations of players around the league that haven't won yet. You know, and there's just two other ones. And so I'm really looking forward to the challenge.
So, Howard, at least they're saying the right things right now, that Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid are two guys that can win together at a high level. Daryl takes an interesting approach to the rosters. He likes to think outside the box sometimes. When you see Daryl Morey and now you see Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid, how do you see that playing out?
Well, I, no matter who was in charge, Chris, no matter who the coach was, no matter who the GM was, my belief was, given the way that the Sixers season went, strange season for the whole world, of course, but also, you know, Simmons gets hurt and that impacts them in the bubble, and now you can't properly assess things. You needed to at least commit to one more year with those two together before you break up a tandem of two all NBA caliber players, two, you know, perennial top 15 to top 20 players who are young, not even quite in their primes yet, still pre-prime, and you don't just give up on that no matter how many bumps in the road you've seen. And especially if you were changing coaches, you always give the new coach the chance to unlock that potential and figure out the right chemistry, and to give a chance for the front office to retool around them. Maybe that, you know, they just needed a better supporting cast, whatever it may be. You don't pull the plug. With Daryl and Doc now there together, all the more so. Doc is going to want a chance to figure out the best way to deploy these two and see if he can unlock again that the potential of this superstar duo. And Daryl's going to want the chance to reformat the roster. Can they move Al Horford's contract, Richardson's contract, Tobias Harris, whoever it may be? So, of course, first of all, Daryl in his opening press conference is not going to come out and say, this thing is stuck in a ditch. We gotta trade Ben Simmons. I'm going to go get James Harden instead. I mean, that would be fun, but I don't think we're ever going to hear a press conference like that. To an extent, they're saying what you would expect, but I also think it's the realistic approach. Got to give these guys a full normal-ish season with the new coach and his plan, and with the new GM and the way, and however he can help them by restructuring the roster.
Yeah, I agree. He's certainly not going to come out and say, I'm looking to move off either one of those guys at this point. And I would also say, I don't believe for a second that Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid are anywhere near the top of the Sixers' problems. They were, to remind people again, one bouncing ball away from potentially beating the eventual champs just a year or so ago. So,
yes,
they were good enough to be on that level back then. They just need the right pieces around them. Unfortunately, Philadelphia decided to reshape that roster by letting Butler go, by letting Redick go, and that cost them. If they can get Butler and Redick type of guys, or at least guys that fit around Simmons and Embiid, they're going to be fine. I would not, unless you were getting a king's ransom in exchange for Ben Simmons or Joel Embiid. And I'm not even sure James Harden at this point is that king's ransom. Like, James Harden is on the other side of 30 now and is still a great player, but there's far more longevity, I think, in Simmons and Embiid to make a deal like that, at least at this point. So I'd keep them together, and I think Daryl's going to keep them together at least from the start, at least for one more season, and see what he has with that group. All right, let me finish with your backyard. And the most interesting team in the NBA to me next season, Howard, is the Brooklyn Nets. The Nets, we know, have a talented roster headlined by Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. They hired Steve Nash to be the head coach, and now they have fleshed out Nash's staff with some proven hands. You've got Jacque Vaughn, who was already coming back, and now Mike D'Antoni, who has a long history with Nash, and Ime Udoka, a rising coaching candidate himself, will join him on Nash's staff. Before I get to that dynamic, Howard, does it say anything to you about the state of Houston that Mike D'Antoni just ran away to go be an assistant and Daryl Morey was a free agent for, like, again, a long weekend before he took another job there? Because my antenna popped up pretty quickly when I saw Mike D'Antoni assistant coach. Not that Mike would take an assistant coaching job anywhere else. Obviously, his history with Nash plays a big role in that, but he left. He could have come back to the Rockets on some kind of deal as the head coach. He chose not to. Daryl chose not to, took a new job very quickly. I wondered a lot about, what those two thought about what was going on in Houston when these moves happened.
Yeah, I mean, my gut tells me that we have not heard the complete story yet of this final year of the Daryl Morey, Mike D'Antoni, Houston Rockets, James Harden, Russell Westbrook, Tillman Fertitta partnership, right? Like, there's more than meets the eye here. Now, we knew there were some, look, the waters were murky anyway, because, Tillman Fertitta had made a big deal about not extending Mike D'Antoni a year ago. A lot of that, was in the newspapers, was in the media every day, Fertitta versus Warren Legere, Mike's agent. And so, there was already, the table had been set. Every sign pointed to Mike leaving after this past season. So that part wasn't that big of a surprise. I also think trading for Russell Westbrook made his job harder, a lot harder. And I don't mean, it was another big personality or anything like that. I just mean that just functionally, you traded a guy in Chris Paul who was a great shooter from both deep and mid-range for a complete non-shooter in Westbrook who needs the ball in his hands a lot. Like, I was never a fan of that particular move anyway, just as a basketball matter. And I do think, and there's every indication in the world, and there's been some reporting along these lines too, that trade was more about what Tillman Fertitta wanted and what James Harden wanted than it was about what Daryl or Mike D'Antoni wanted. And both those guys are gone, and that doesn't mean I'm right to believe these things are all linked. But I think that there's some linkages in all of this. I think that's part of the picture. It's part of why they're gone. I think that Fertitta inherited both of them when he took over as owner, and he's clearly pretty impulsive, pretty self-assured. His book is something like "Shut Up and Listen." I think that probably it's not been the most pleasant environment there. I'm not surprised that those guys are leaving, and I'm not saying it's all on Fertitta, but I think that that's an element there. And also, look, again, I'm not the only one in the league who thinks or who covers this league or from folks who work in the league who thinks that the Rockets have plateaued and are now going to start the slow decline. You're not breaking through. You're not knocking off the Warriors, Lakers, Clippers, Nuggets. You are at best fifth in the conference, and you're not trending upward because you got two guards in their early 30s who are going to erode, and no cap maneuverability and very little in the way of trade assets. So good time to get out.
Yeah, I agree. I'm one of the people that think the Rockets have plateaued. Harden's a great player. I'm a huge fan of Russell Westbrook, always have been. But when you have these guys on the other side of 30, it's more likely than not that they decline a little bit, especially Westbrook, who's so reliant on athleticism to succeed at his highest level. I think it's possible, down the line we do hear that Daryl and Mike just want to get out while the getting was good at this point and move on to potentially greener pasture. But let's talk about that Nets pasture, so to speak. You've got a situation in Brooklyn which is really interesting because of the talent on that roster. Now you add some proven hands to the coaching staff in D'Antoni and Udoka, and of course Jacques Vaughn still being there. I mean, do you look at these additions as being real boons for Brooklyn? Are there any kind of warning signs when you have a new head coach that has to earn authority in that locker room, and you bring in a coach in Mike D'Antoni who has earned authority in other locker rooms, more combustible locker rooms, and Jacques Vaughn, who already has a faction of players that are probably pretty loyal to him with that team? How do you view the coaching staff now in Brooklyn?
Yeah, look, I mean, Chris, we in the media sometimes over-dramatize these situations a bit. A year ago we were saying, how is Frank Vogel going to have any authority in LA when he's got Jason Kidd and Lionel Hollins on his staff, two guys who have a lot of head coaching experience, Lionel in particular, and Jason Kidd, who has a history of being a bit of a disruptive force and going his own way. And, there was jokes about how long is Frank Vogel even going to be the head coach? Next thing you know, he's the one, winning the championship and shouting awkwardly into a microphone in an empty arena. It's a valid question, Chris. Steve Nash is a rookie head coach with two strong personalities, two superstars in KD and Kyrie Irving. But Mike D'Antoni, first of all, obviously he and Nash have a pre-existing relationship going back years to Phoenix. Mike coming in as a resource and as a guy who, he's got his own ego for sure, but he's not like a big, bold personality who's going to like take over the room. I don't think like players are going to be confused about who's in charge. Mike has been around a long time and is, I think understands how to navigate those dynamics. Jacques Vaughn's a little bit different because, yes, there's some carryover there. He's the guy who was elevated when Kenny Atkinson was fired, and there were a lot of fingerprints from the stars on that. And so do those guys – would there be a loyalty to Jacques Vaughn? I mean, obviously they appreciate him. Obviously they like what he was doing as the interim head coach. But then again, Steve Nash isn't head coach today if not for KD having a relationship with him from their days with the Warriors when Nash was a skills coach or consulting, whatever he was doing, and working with KD a lot. So I don't think there's any question about chain of command or who's in charge. I do think it's great when you're a rookie head coach or a young head coach in this league to have former head coaches on your staff. It makes sense. That's the rational way to go. And when you're, Nash is kind of an egoless guy. If you're not caught up in all of those concerns, then you value the experience more than you feel threatened by it. And so I think they'll be fine. And Ime Udoka, you know, has been identified for years as a guy who people, you know, coming off of Pop's staff and in San Antonio, most recently with Philly, but because of the Pop, you know, aura about him, has always been looked at as a guy who's going to have a chance to be a head coach in this league. He's had some interviews, and that's coming. But he's another guy, just a really smart assistant coach, smart guy to have on the bench. I think it's a good staff.
I think it's an excellent staff. And I think just like with a front office, the more talent you add to your coaching staff, the better. And I've said this before. I mean, Mike D'Antoni, as you well know, is not coming to Brooklyn to usurp the power of Steve Nash or to, you know, to undercut him in any possible way. I would say, though, all this, and you're right, the media does, myself included, does tend to overreact to this type of stuff. But the backdrop to all this is Kyrie. And some of the comments Kyrie has made this offseason, specifically on that podcast where he talked about coach by committee, which was a little bit of a bizarre statement. And Howard, my own experience from covering Kyrie pretty close in Boston, where he clashed with Brad Stevens. And he might be one of, at most, a handful of players who have ever clashed with Brad Stevens, who have ever really questioned his coaching bona fides or disagreed with him when it came to basketball-related decisions. If Kyrie does that in Brooklyn with a coach that's far less experienced than Brad Stevens, and Steve Nash might turn out to be just as good a coach, we just don't know about that yet, but that could cause some consternation within that team if Kyrie isn't on board. I think KD will be on board for the reason you mentioned. He had to have been on board. I mean, he would work with Nash in Golden State. They had a prior relationship. There really isn't a prior relationship between Kyrie and Steve Nash, except for the fact they played the same position. And maybe that leads to a bond between Kyrie and Steve Nash. But for right now, that to me is like the gray area in all this, the unknown in all this. Will Kyrie be fully on board with how Steve Nash coaches that team? If he's not, I mean, will he gravitate towards another coach, or will it cause a distraction? Will it cause a problem for a team that needs to gel pretty quickly, especially if this season starts with a truncated training camp and a 72-game season that's kind of molded together with, you know, double-digit back-to-backs? That's the only thing. If there wasn't that kind of Kyrie dynamic present, I probably wouldn't be list this as a topic. It'd probably be a good thing that they added all these pieces of the puzzle, because Kyrie said what he said and is who he is. It raises a bit of a red flag.
Well, I would say this. Is there any head coach Kyrie has played for in the NBA that he hasn't gone at and made life difficult for? I mean, probably.
Unclear, yeah. Unclear.
Byron Scott, David Blatt. I mean, everybody.
Ty Lue,
right?
Yeah.
Ty Lue, Brad Stevens. I mean, in the case of Steve Nash, at least, look, far be it for me to try to understand the way that Kyrie's brain works, who he would respect and what head coach he wouldn't necessarily challenge or undermine. But Steve Nash will be the first two-time MVP he's played for. So there's that. Maybe that makes a difference. We sometimes overstate how NBA friendships work too. And so everybody assumes that KD and Kyrie will work well together because they're buddies. I don't assume that at all. I think that's yet to be seen. But if we're doing the benefit of the doubt approach here, KD clearly values having Steve Nash as head coach, and he has the relationship with him, whether by the transitive property that means that Kyrie will also respect him via KD, I don't know. But that's a really, really bad use of the phrase transitive property, by the way. That has nothing to do with it. Kids don't listen to sports writers for math lessons. That's on you. Don't listen. I think, though, it's almost irrelevant who the head coach is if we're worried about Kyrie. Kyrie's always going to do what Kyrie does. It's more about how the coaching staff deals with those flare-ups if they come. And they got a lot of experience, as we just went over. So I think they'll be able to roll with that. I just think, more than anything, Chris, there's just some fundamental basketball questions there. Like, on the one hand, as you put it, they're possibly the most interesting team in the NBA, but it's also with all these caveats. Like, we all will pencil them as a contender in the East immediately, and we should, We should, because they've earned that based on their talent. But Kyrie played 20 games in his first year in Brooklyn. He's got an injury history. Kevin Durant hasn't played in a year and a half, and he's got, obviously, he's coming back from the toughest injury there is in the Achilles. We don't know what he'll look like. We don't know how well they'll function together. We don't know how Caris LeVert and Spencer Dinwiddie, if they're still on the roster and not traded, how they'll adapt to having less control over the offense, the ball in their hands less. Are they re-signing Joe Harris? What will that cost? Is DeAndre Jordan the starting center because he's got the right friends, or is it Jared Allen? How will Steve Nash function as a rookie head coach? Like, none of these are reasons to dismiss them, but they're just, they are valid questions about a team that on paper looks like a contender, but has a lot to prove because it's all new.
Did you think, just to finish this, did you think that when Steve Nash retired, that head coaching would be, you know, one of his next steps? I mean, you covered him extensively over the years. Did you believe he had that kind of makeup? Because he is, you know, kind of a laid back type of guy. You know, he succeeded certainly in Phoenix, in Dallas, but, you know, in a combustible situation in LA, I know he wasn't playing, but he wasn't playing a significant role in kind of healing the rift between Kobe and Dwight Howard during that year. How did you view Nash? Did you look at him as you know, head coaching material?
Well, I mean, head coaching material for sure. You know, if what you're talking about is basketball acumen and communication
sure,
skills.
Sure, definitely has that. Definitely has that.
Right. And the thing is, Chris, we would check off a bunch of really important boxes with him in terms of what makes a great head coach, especially in today's NBA. You need to be, and he talks about this all the time. Like, I've been impressed in the way he talks about, he sounds a lot like Steve Kerr, which makes sense. I think they're built a little similarly personality-wise, and also he spent some time working with the Warriors. But Steve Nash uses the word connectivity a lot, and he's always talking about, you know, how you meaning the players with each other, and the players and the coaches, everybody kind of being on the same page, and that the head coach's role is more of this, you know, collaborative person. So when Kyrie says, and yes, it was still weird that Kyrie said any of us could be the coach on a given day. I mean, Kerr would probably too, but Steve Nash would, I think, agree on some level that, listen, we all are smart about the game. We all have thoughts on the game, and players see things that the coaches don't. Kerr, again, talks about that with his guys, with Draymond and Steph all the time, that they see things I don't, and he defers to them at times. And I think the smart head coaches in today's game, they understand that. They understand that it's not just that players have more authority than they've ever had or the stars do. It's also that these guys are really smart. They see the game from a different perspective while they're in the game. The coach shouldn't necessarily try to constantly impose himself in that old school, top-down, you know, authoritarian type of style. It's more, in today's NBA, you're better off as more of, as the collaborator. And I think that Steve Nash, when it comes to his communication skills, his laid-back personality, that does him good. That serves him well in this kind of situation with two larger-than-life stars that he's coaching. So I think he's built for this. Whether, I mean, listen, I didn't think he'd be a head coach because most players at his level don't become head coach because coaching is a grind. And if you've been a superstar in this league, you've made a ton of money and you don't need the job. That's why it's usually lesser players or the film room guy, or now college coaches. There's all these other head coaching models in the NBA. It's not usually a highly accomplished ex-player because they've already made a ton of money, and coaching is harder. It's the hours are crappy, and you could be fired any given day, and everything is your fault. And so I did not see it coming with Nash. I can't wait to see how he does. I mean, I think he's going to do fantastically. I think he's going to be great, but it's not something I necessarily would have predicted.
Yeah, he's an excellent basketball mind, no question about that, who certainly will catch on the X's and O's of coaching very quickly. It's just I wonder if the politics of being a head coach and dealing with a locker room and having to be a voice in that locker room every single day to, you know, just blend people together, you know, deal with conflicts. That's what I'm going to be most interested to watch when it comes to Nash as a head coach. That's why that team is the most interesting team in the league to me going into next season. Howard, always great to talk to you, man. Enjoy you know, poll watching, whatever we're doing the next couple of days. And thanks for joining me, man.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.